This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. My name is Patsy Gill. I can tell you today that dreams really do come true, because today I have my hero and one of America's greatest heroes as my first guest. Colonel Leo Thorsness is the winner of the Medal of Honor and the author of a book called Surviving Hell, The Story of a POW. I am so excited to have him on. Hello, Colonel Thorsness.
Well, hello. How are you this morning?
Oh, fine. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me today. I was up at 0400 hours, as I am every time I'm working on this very important project to me called Forgotten F-105 Warriors. It's such an honor and thrill for me to have you on the phone because, as I mentioned to you, I think of you almost every morning at 0400 hours.
Just know, flattery goes a long way with me. What can I do for you?
Well, it's so great to have you here. I have with me in the studio, and they just want to say hi, Tracy Stanich and Tina Basil. Tina is the wife of G.I. Basil, who wrote the great book Pack Six, and they both just want to say hi to you, and I'm going to talk to them after I talk to you.
Hi, Leon.
Sure.
Hi.
Hi, Tracy. Hi, Tina. Nice to chat with you.
Oh, you too.
Well, you know, it is because of them that I became involved in the whole F-105 world, which is a thrilling world. And they asked me to do a screenplay of Pack Six, and it was a joy. And then in doing that, I met so many wonderful people, including, I know, so many of your friends. And I was so thrilled to include in my project the ground crew men. Because, you know, when I talked to the pilots, they always said they couldn't have done it without the ground crews. So my project, F-105 Warriors, is about both the pilots and the ground crews. Let me just give a little background to people who don't know, but in March of 1965, President Lyndon Baines Johnson initiated a bombing campaign designed to persuade the North Vietnamese to surrender. It didn't work. And at some point, you come into the picture. Tell us, when did you arrive in Thak Le?
I arrived there in October of 1966, and I went there as a wild weasel, which, as you know, some of your listeners may not, that was when the Soviet Union put surface-to-air missile sites into North Vietnam, it was the first time we'd been exposed to them. They took away a chunk of airspace for the guys who were carrying bombs. And so our industry and military got together, created some black boxes, put them in a two-place 105F, put an electronic warfare officer in the back, experienced pilot like me in the front, and we became known as the Wild Weasel Crews.
Well, the F-105 was a remarkable airplane. It wasn't the easiest airplane to fly, and it was an enormous airplane.
It was a very large airplane, and the 105F was just a little bit longer, so you put the two-place cockpit in there. But it was a tough airplane. It was not designed for air-to-air. It was designed to carry a nuclear weapon during the Cold War. It had an internal bomb bay, only fire to do so. Of course, we put a gas tank in there in Vietnam, and it became the workhorse of the front part of the Vietnam War, and then towards the latter part, the F-4s became more dominant.
Well, I know that it was about the same size as B-17, which needed a crew of about a dozen people, and so to be a pilot of an F-105 was a pretty great accomplishment.
Well, just, you know, you train for whatever your job is, and you take it day at a time, and you learn how the systems work, and then you're it.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to some young people recently about the F-105, and I mentioned that, you know, it was a supersonic airplane, but they could fly over the treetops. And, you know, somehow nowadays, you know, with the jets flying so high and they can drop their bombs from such a distance, people don't remember that how very, very dangerous it was for you guys that you had to go in low.
Well, we did at times, and also sometimes outrun a SAM or they launch at you if you're over the Delta. It's kind of a thrill to be supersonic at 20 feet, but we could do that. Not for real long because it sucks up a lot of fuel, but if you had to use it, you could do it.
Well, you know, I have flown your mission on the mission where you earned your great honor and of winning the Medal of Honor, and I've flown it so many times in my mind. Tell us about it, because, you know, nobody understands, you know, it's so hard to understand, and even pilots I talk to, you know, the F-105 is not the most maneuverable airplane, and against a MiG, it wasn't really, it had a lot of problems, right?
It did. The MiG could outturn us. It was a small, light airplane with pretty good-sized wings. We flew a great big airplane, what we said, with itty-bitty wings, and you go really fast. But it wasn't a training airplane. It wasn't designed for air-to-air. So to do that, you either had to be lucky and some MiG flew in front of your gun sight, or you had to maneuver the airplane such that you just outsmarted the MiG a little bit and got a temporary advantage. And then with the Gatling gun, which is like a buzzsaw, if you get it in your gun sight, he's yours.
Well, on April 19th, 1967, you were finished with your mission when, what happened? Explain to us what happened, and how did you go back into the fray, so to speak?
Weasels had four airplanes. He had a wingman and two, he had three wingmen and a weasel person with two planes. And my number three man, which happened to be had an extra airplane, he was a weasel also. But anyway, weasel, the only two airplanes left in North Vietnam, the bombing had finished, and the weasel job, we'd go in first, try to find these SAM sites and hold them down by threatening them or just try to kill them with bombs if they were ready to launch or had launched their SAMs. And then we were the first in and last out. So we were always short on fuel because there were 2 or 3 or 4 minutes between flights of four airplanes. So they were in the airplane. The bombers were in the area about 3 or 4 minutes, and we were in 10 or 15 minutes. So our loss rate was twice theirs. At any rate, we were the last ones coming out, and my wingman was hit badly, had him turned towards the foothills. So any possible chance of rescue, the airplane quit. That was the other weasel airplane, and that particular flight had two of them. And so they ejected, and while they were floating down the parachute, picked up a MiG that was rolling in on one of the parachutes. He was going to shoot him in the parachute, which is not protocol. And he was more concentrated on shooting the guy in the pilot than he was on me, and so we ended up shooting that airplane down. And then a little later, but we were out of gun film, so we got credit for a probable rather than a confirmed kill. And in and out, got fuel, came back in, still the only two, and then finally another flight of four airplanes came in trying to help out in this potential rescue operation, which did not succeed. And there was a flight of four airplanes came in, and Harry and I were by ourselves because we'd lost our wingman, so we were in there, and we were taking on all of North Vietnam by ourselves. That wasn't our intent, but that was just the odds that turned out. At any rate, another airplane ended up shorter of fuel than Harry and I, called and said, Leo, I got 600 pounds, that means 6 minutes, and so we gave our tanker to him, and he got hooked up with about zero fuel indicating, saved him, and Harry and I figured if we could get to 35,000 feet within 70 miles of the Mekong River, we could flame out, we'd out of fuel, and the airplane would glide 2 miles per 1,000 feet at 270 knots. And so we set up that glide, where fuel was indicating zero, and thought if we can get to the Mekong, we can eject. If we get past that, we're in Thailand, we're free, versus Laos. And sure, and not only did we get to Thailand, we made about another 7 or 8 miles and landed with no fuel on an airbase in Thailand.
Which in itself an amazing landing and an amazing thing to do, to glide in all that distance and to land so easily. It's a fantastic story. But what you missed is you didn't say about how you actually flew. You were on your way out, and you flew back to position and to make sure that the the MiGs didn't attack the rescue airplane, and you flew back and got caught in what they call a wagon wheel, where you were surrounded by.
Well, we went back in there. I'm sorry. We went back in and by ourselves, and I remember Harry and I had a short, my backseater, Harry Johnson, we had a short conversation. When we got fuel, we said, we need some help to go back in and see if there's any potential of getting a rescue operation going. And there's always mixed up in combats, and that was one of them. So we were the only airplane that went back in the North Vietnam. But before we, just we were leaving the tanker to go back in again, I said, Harry, we know the odds, don't we? He said, and good old Harry, he said, yep, he said, but there's nobody else knows where they are. I mean, we were mill-matched. So we did go in back in by ourselves. We knew MiGs would be waiting. We did fly into the middle of their wagon wheel, they call it. And so I had a little bit of ammo left, and that's when I shot down that second MiG or got the Bravo for it. And then pulled the MiGs off that one remaining Sandy airplane that was still there. One got shot down in the rescue operation. And we pulled the MiGs off him, outmaneuvered him. And so he got out, and we got out, but the rescue was not successful, which was just totally heartbreaking.
And that is what is called going above and beyond, which is the requirement for the Medal of Honor, which you so justly deserved. But of course, you didn't know about that for many years, because 11 days later, on April 30th, 1967, you became the 237th F-105 pilot shot down.
Yes, and we were on a 93rd mission. You're supposed to, the last 10 missions, you got to go home at 100. The last 10, you're supposed to be sort of easy missions, but in the weasel business, there were no easy targets because our job was to kill SAM sites, and those were up around Hanoi. So we were on a 93rd mission, and they turned over a mountain peak and accelerated to 600 knots to launch the little missile we had. We got an air-to-air warning. I called the MiG-CAT flight, which are F-4s, about 10 miles in trail. I said, hey, you know, Cadillac here, I got air-to-air. And basically, they said something like, you know, have no fear, we're here. You know, F-4 drivers. No, I'm giving a hard time. But anyway, they said it's probably our radar. And so I didn't do anything for a couple seconds, and I was getting ready to launch the missile. And a MiG was in that valley behind that mountain peak. My wingman and I, there were two MiGs there. They couldn't keep up at 600 knots. Didn't have to. They pulled their nose up, and here sat two big, fat 105s. They hosed off their air-to-air missiles, Russian copy of our Sidewinder. And both my wingman and I, I went up the tailpipes, and we kind of blew us out of the air. And Harry and I both ejected within a second or so because everything was gone. You could feel pieces coming off, cockpit full of smoke. And Harry went out, and Harry's Bagley. I went out, and my feet went. You're sitting in a seat, and imagine yourself just sitting down, my feet went straight sideways at my knees, so both my knees were blown out. But in a couple seconds later, I still don't know if I heard it, or I felt it, or if I saw it, or some or all of those. But a couple seconds after we got out, the airplane imploded, and even though we knew we were ejecting, we'd probably be injured because we were going way too fast, we got out. And we'd seen airplanes before us trying to slow down, and the same thing happened. The guy never got out, so we decided early on we would take our injuries and go while the still airplane was, well, we could still eject it, and it happened.
Wow.
It's even today when I think about it, it's so hard to think of. And knowing what you went through, and of course in your book Surviving Hell, you talk about those years. And when I think about it, on that day, that was your second flight. You had already flown on the morning run, and you took the afternoon run also.
Yeah, we were only supposed to fly one mission, but they needed another weasel that day, so Harry and I filled in as a spare. And if you got 20 airplanes, you could try to have one spare or one weasel flight, and we filled in a spare, and it turned out the guy airplane broke, was still on the ground, so we filled in, and that just happened to be, that's how the deck was played that day. So,
you know, at that time, in April of 67, we were 2 years into Operation Rolling Thunder, which President Johnson had planned to last about 2 or 3 weeks. Of course, it went on to last much longer. And as I said, you were the 237th plane shot down. Now, many of the guys were killed in action. Some were rescued. And of course, many of you became POWs. That was that was a very difficult time for you when you were captured. Do you want to talk about it?
Well, just in brief, North Vietnam, like nearly all nations, had signed the Geneva Convention, which says when you capture your enemy, combatant, a military man, they're supposed to give you, as I did to them, name, rank, serial number, date of birth. They're not supposed to torture or abuse you physically or mentally beyond that. They totally ignored their signature, and torture became routine. And for the first 18 days and nights, it was hard. I wasn't sure I'd survive. And you pray to pass out, and you things happen to you, and sounds come out of you, and all that kind of stuff. But a very, very brutal time. And at some point in there, I don't remember when, but I remember I broke, and I went past those four words, and that was the most devastating moment of my life, because I thought, I'm not worthy. I was sure in my mind other POWs ahead of me had survived and held out, and they were the Rambo guys. And so I remember I tried to cry. I was past tears, and I hoped that I would. I said, maybe I can die if there's nobody to commit suicide. Or you didn't want to, but we'll just survive as strong. But you hope to pass that or something. And then I also hoped that I wouldn't live with another POW, because I knew they would have made it. And when they did put me in with another POW, just after those 18 days and nights, I really couldn't walk. They rolled me in there, and there was a guy in there I knew, Jim Heitschu, who since died. I'd known him at Tak Lee, but we didn't recognize each other. We changed so much. He had shut down about 6 weeks before I was. Anyway, I started telling him what a failure I was, and I really wouldn't look at him. And he said, Leo, don't you know? And I said, what's that? He said, just knock it off. He said, everybody who went through that type of torture, one of two things happened. They either broke or they died, and some did both. So I'd never been so pleased to be average. Average is really good.
And, of course, the hardest thing was thinking about your wife and your daughter, who were not even aware of what happened to you, didn't know if you were alive or dead, which was a torture in itself for them.
Yeah, when I was floating down, I knew I'd either be killed or captured. And I thought, and Harry and I, we were the best weasel crew going. We shot down some MiGs, we killed more SAM sites, we were on a 93rd mission. We taught other weasels, and yet I'm the pilot, so I'm the boss of the airplane. And I knew I'd had to make a mistake, or we wouldn't be floating down. And that was just him. And my thought behind that was, if I die down here, will my family, my wife and daughter, ever find out what happened to me? Because we already had friends before us that the husband or the father was shot down, and wife, it's a terrible condition. You don't know if they're dead or alive. And my thought was, behind that, I made a mistake. I failed them. And to think you failed your family, that's a very, very difficult thing to accept.
But you did a rather wonderful thing in prison. You built yourself a room. Tell us about the room that you built yourself.
Well, I just we all had different ways of passing time, and so I created a room, and we had no pencils, no papers, no nothing, and you're in a little cell. I spent a year in a 5.5 by 6 foot cell, and you just mentally. I created a little room that I had files in there, and I had files on my friends, and I had files about flying, and I had files about when I was a Boy Scout, about my childhood living as a farm kid. It was a great pastime to force my mind to think about something other than the terrible situation you're in. And I think many of us did things like that. But you got to do something if you lament and say, why me? Why am I here? Will I ever survive? Will we ever get out of here? Life gets just more difficult. So many of us found artificial ways to put ourselves mentally in some other part of the world or some other part of our life that was pleasant and good and the kind of life we like to have as Americans.
You know, when I started this project, the two people who influenced me the most were Big Bill Cook, who was a ground crew
right.
Specialist, and he also is one who keeps the entire F-105 community always informed about everything that is happening. And he's given me a lot of his time and talks to me quite often. And, of course, Billy Sparks. Now, I loved Billy Sparks, and he was also a weasel and shot down, but luckily he was rescued. And so he was also important to you because he's the one who put together the the whole recommendation for your Medal of Honor.
Right. He did a lot of research, and then later was, yeah, he was, and Bill Sparks, I had known him before, for long years before that. And Bill Sparks is such, he was just such an outstanding.
He was funny.
He probably drank too much. He cussed too much. He just truly enjoyed life. But if I'm going to fly somebody's wing in combat, it'd either be Bill Sparks or Jack Broughton, who's my wing commander there. I mean, they were just outstanding aviators, outstanding people. They put their life on the line for you. That way, I'm just it's too bad when Bill died, and I talked to him a few times not long before that. But what a phenomenal man! What a phenomenal man! And you mentioned, I just want to mention, you know, the combat. We come back to the Bill Cook, the ground people, and I often tell the story about an example of teamwork. And one is, I said the three levels. The first one is the ground people, and I said we'd yank and bank those airplanes at 105. We get some flat holes in them, and we were right at the edge of the envelope. Sometimes we went past it, and they were terrible shape when we came back. But the ground people, the fabricators, the crew chiefs, everybody on the ground, they worked all night. They were so dedicated. They were so, you know, so much into that's their airplane. You're my guy if you're flying it. That it was like the next morning we came out to fly those old 105s, they were like a brand new airplane. They were just so phenomenal. And my second level was the team members. And there's always a key guy in an airplane. That's not me. I called it Harry because he knows so much about electronics that he got us out of trouble sometimes before we get in trouble. But I just can't say enough about the ground crew folks, that what a phenomenal job they did keeping our airplanes going.
They're amazing, and they're keeping the story alive.
Yes, they are.
They're working very hard to keep these memories alive, and that's why I appreciate all the work that they're doing with me on Forgotten F-105 Warriors. You know, they come from a cross section of America. And so many of them, of course, come from the Midwest and from states, you know, little towns from all over America. And, of course, you come from one of the most famous little towns in the world, not just in America, Walnut Grove, Minnesota.
There is such a place as Little House on the Prairie, and I went to school there and dated there and joined the military from there. And it's at least 800 or 900 people now.
Oh, wow. That's a big city.
Yeah, but it was, like a lot of people come from the Midwest, and they seem to be good. Well, there's good people everywhere, but I'm a little biased maybe because you grew up with that work ethic and small-town stuff. And in my era, there was no such thing as drugs. There was Boy Scouts and a few things like that. And it was just I lived on a farm for a long time. And, you know, Mom and Dad, brother, sister, and Leo, and we worked hard. We were poor. We didn't know it. We never were hungry. We were farmers. It was just thinking back.
Well, so did I. You know, I come from northern Michigan. I'm a Youper. And the same kind of, you know, small town and farm families, and it's exactly that, and very patriotic people who were, of course, so many of the young men do look to the military and join the military. And so when you were young, had you thought about becoming a pilot when you were a kid, or it came to you later on?
Well, not so much as a pilot. As when I was young, I knew I'd serve in the military because everybody did that. And when I was my brother's 2 years older than I, he was in Korea, and I thought it's time for me to get something going. And it turned out that they needed pilots. And in baseball, in high school, I'd majored in baseball, basketball, football, and girls. I wasn't much of an academic, but I had a wonderful high school. So when it came time to take some coordination tests and so on for pilot tests and so on, I was well coordinated and smart enough just to get by the academics. But it just turned out, and once I get in an airplane, and the first time I flew solo, I thought to myself, Leo, you just found home. They pay you to have that much fun. They paid us. It was a great occupation and career until I got shut down.
And of course, while you were, before you joined, you met your sweetheart, and since you are born on Valentine's Day, you were her lifelong sweetheart.
Well, sure. I mean, what chance did she have when I was born on Valentine's
Day? That's right. that's it. When you meet a guy who's born on Valentine's Day.
I met her in the registration, first day of line, registration line, the first day of college, and that was the best thing I did in college. I met her, and we were somebody the other day, and they said, well, how are you married now? And my wife Gillian, and I said, well, we're 61 years, and we said, we're working up, but we think it's going to work yet. We're still working. A wonderful lady, just a wonderful lady.
And you know, my boys were also both Eagle Scouts, and one of them took that trip from Minnesota to Canada carrying canoes.
Oh, that was We paddled, rode out of Ely. That was a great trip. What a fun time that was.
It's a wonderful experience and a wonderful thing. You know, I know when you were in, I was very lucky last year, Carlisle Smitty Harris visited me here in Florida, and he was one of the first F-105 pilots shot down. I think he was actually number 6 shot down and one of the first POWs.
Right.
And, of course, he's the one who came out with this TAP code, which really was very important to you guys in the Hanoi Hilton and the other facilities you were kept in.
Without question, being able to communicate. If you can communicate, even if you're solitary in these little cells, basically 3 years were brutal and solitary and hard. The last 3 years were big cells. You could talk out loud and much easier, but torture was normal. But you know, those first 3 years, if to communicate at times truly meant the difference between life and death. Now, if you're in cell one and they torture you today and the government decides they need another batch of propaganda or something, they torture and torture, and if you get back to cell that night, I'm in cell two, it's my turn tomorrow. If you and I can communicate, we use that TAP code, I can find out what they wanted. Did they break you? If so, what lie did you tell? Keep it simple so you remember. But and knowing what we had names for different. My odds of survival tomorrow are better. And we use it for other things too. But communication is life and death. And also, if you can communicate, even if you're solitary, if you can communicate, you can organize. And if you can organize, you can resist or at least better. There's strength in the number, kind of. And it was just that TAP code was life and death.
Now, did you ever meet Gene Basil, whose wife is here and his daughter's here? Did you ever meet him?
Well, I think I did because I know the name. But maybe it's because I know the name. You know, I go back that many years now, and so he was not a POW.
No, Tina, where was Gene?
And when?
Yeah, when was he stationed?
We were in Japan, in Misawa, and then we went for training in Las Vegas, and Billy Sparks was a good friend of ours.
Maybe I know you from Nellis.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and so anyway, you know, then he went on to Takli.
Right, yep. So.
And then he was shot down. He was hit by a missile, you know, a surface-to-air missile.
Was February 28th, 1968.
And he flew, so he ended up flying 78 and a half missions.
When did you get to Takli?
He got to Takli in October.
The beginning of
67.
October 67.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
then
yeah.
He was shot down in, I think he was shot down in Laos.
Okay. Yeah, I got there and was shot down just before he got there. So,
Right.
Vegas. Yep.
And, I'm
so pleased that he got picked up.
Yeah, Tom Kirk, Tom Kirk was at Nellis also. They went there together, and he was a POW for seven years.
Huh? Yep.
And let's see who else was there. Bob Sturm was training at that time.
And Gene was rescued by the Jolly Greens. So.
Yeah, he was the 1,000th rescued.
Man.
So he got put in the paper, you know, and that's how I found out.
I dreamed of that.
Oh, I know.
By the way, you and especially, I shouldn't say especially, but Patsy, I'm just so pleased that you've taken on this project and you put so much into it. It's keeping a little sliver of history alive about a unique airplane, and it's also just overall some stuff about the war that most people don't know and probably never will, but you're helping do that. So,
well, I think, you know, it's important when you think about it, how many missions were flown. It was supposed to be a four-week maximum event. It landed up being 4 years, and a quarter of a million missions were flown.
Yeah.
And the tragedy is that we don't learn from history, and hopefully when, you know, bringing this story out and keeping it alive, maybe somebody will learn from history. Because, you know, as one of the guys told me, using a bomber to send a message isn't really a great idea. And it's sort of also, you know, you have to decide if you're going to win or not win.
Mm-hmm.
And not drag it out as you guys suffered so, really, you were willing to do the job, but in so many ways you were hampered.
Yeah, the rules of engagement now are just as bad, maybe. But in our case, you know, if a church, you couldn't strike a target, missiles or anything within 2 miles of a pagoda or church. Well, guess where they put their SAM sites? Their flax, or you know, it was just, we couldn't fire within 25 miles of China border. You get engaged with them, you couldn't destroy a MiG on the ground. I'd see him sitting there, you'd see him taxiing out. You couldn't touch him. It was you had to wait for airborne. Just a dumb war. And if you're going to go to war, everybody knows this. You go to win. And and then Johnston and McNamara, they stopped bombing, as you know, over the North Vietnam, in 16 or somewhere in there. And we were sure we were going to go home, because in North Vietnam, the only thing going on there was the war. It was the bombing. The ground war was in the South. And so when they stopped bombing, that was the only leverage, the only pressure they had to get the release of the POWs. And so there was no doubt in our mind when we found out the bombing had been halted that we were going home. We said no American president would just let us sit here. And we sat there a couple more years with nothing going on. It was a dumb war. But anyway,
Leon,
it's behind us.
Leon, did you ever read what Jim Basil did? He did that Pack 6.
Yes, yes.
That book.
Yeah, great book.
Because I was going to send you one.
Yeah.
Leo,
I have to take a quick break. Would you just hold on for a moment? And when we come back, there are a few other things I need to talk to you about.
Okay, I'll try to make my answer shorter.
No.
We want to hear your story.
All right.
Just hold on.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Love a good book? Come out to Orlando for the Indie Book Fest 2015. Hang out with over 60 best-selling authors at Fanfare, where you can chat, take selfies, and get autographs. Enjoy the fun theme parties. Join us July 31st to August 2nd at the beautiful Caribe Royale Hotel in Orlando. To buy tickets, go to www.indiebookfest.com. Find your own story at the Indie Book Fest 2015.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
Need to get out of the house? Tired of watching reruns? Think you can spot talent? Well, come out to West Coast Players' 6th annual presentation of one-act plays. See the 11 winners selected from over 250 scripts submitted. Both matinee and evening performances run July 3rd through July 5th and July 10th through July 12th. Conveniently located on US 19, you will enjoy watching the plays presented by the talented West Coast Players. For tickets, go to www.wcplayers.org or type in West Coast Players One Act Plays.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Hi, it's Sawyer from the Dolphin Tale movies. Now is the perfect time to visit the world-famous Clearwater Marine Aquarium. Millions have seen us around the world, and now you can experience what we do in person. Come and reconnect with Winter and her fun-loving movie co-stars, Hope, Mavis, and yes, that crazy bird, Rufus. Immerse yourself into the world of marine life rescue with a behind-the-scenes tour. Explore the film sets, and don't miss our free boating adventure. Save time in line when you buy tickets at seawinter.com. Kids only $16.95.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my guest, Colonel Leo Thorsness, Medal of Honor winner, who spent 2,135 days as a prisoner of war. Colonel Thorsness, thank you for being on my program.
Well, you're more than welcome. And by the way, Patsy, who is your audience?
We don't know. They're spread all over the place. I have We're here in Clearwater. I broadcast out of Clearwater, but the show is also podcast and available on the internet. So we have listeners all over the country, actually all over the world. We even have listeners as far away as Australia.
Wonderful.
So we're trying to spread the word about the Forgotten F-105 Warriors project and our hope to do not just a documentary, but a mini series about it, about all of the F-105 pilots and the ground crews. And so it's a great honor to have you on. And I know that, you know, after all of you went through, you have now given a great deal of your time to recent veterans who are suffering from PTSD. And so tell us me something about how you talk to veterans, and you know, it's so sad. There have been so many suicides among the recent veterans. Tell us about your work with these people.
I work with two organizations specifically. One called the America's Warriors Partnership, and we started out in Augusta, Georgia. And there used to be about 160 people under the bridge, so to speak, you know, on living on the streets. So we got down to about 8. And we're helping them with their families. We're getting into college. We literally take them by the hand, take them to the VA. That's a small organization, but we're up to about 10,000 people helped. Is expanding to other cities. The other one is I'm on the advisory board for the Wounded Warrior Project. And as you know, that's a massively big. And they get, because of the 800-pound gorilla, they get a lot of flack. But they're just doing great operations. I was just with 100 of them at a banquet, and they're in wheelchairs, and they're just... They got like 23 programs now. One of them is Wounded Warrior is building a $500 million endowment to help Wounded Warrior, ones that are really bad, and their parents quit work, and they take care of them at home in the wheelchair and so on. And they wanted to put these guys in a nursing home, and Wounded said, no, you're not going to do that. And so this endowment is working. Even when the parents die, these people will still have enough money for individual caretakers, and so it's a lot. And they help them with college. There's some good programs, there's a lot of other good veteran programs. Some overlap, but that's maybe too bad. But people are trying. But the sad thing is, there's still like 21 or 22 people a day commit suicide. Hard to get our hands around that.
It is hard. And you know, I know that you know all of you guys who were POWs for so many years, and there were when you were finally released. You were released, and when? What was the date?
67, April. Yeah, April 1967.
No, you were released.
It was March 4th, 1973.
1973.
March 4th.
So from 67 to 73, you were a POW. And the wonderful thing that you guys managed to do in the last few years, when you were able to get together, was to help each other, so that when you were finally released, you were more ready for the public getting back into you know, civilian life or military life for those guys who decided to stay in.
We were, when we moved into those big cells, and Ho Chi Minh died, and the families got involved, National League of POWs, MIAs, which is a great program, and our treatment got a lot better, and they started getting bad publicity about torture and so on. And when we moved to the big cells, we consciously talked about, after being there a while, we said, you know, we're going to have a lot of problems if we get home. Where if you stay in the military, you've missed 5 or 6 years of experience, or flying, you get out, private sector, whatever you get into, we're Rip Van Winkle for 6 years. Technology, do we still have a family? Most of us didn't hear, maybe once a year or some never. Are they still there? Where do they live? Our kids, remember now, when we go home, if you thought you were, if my daughter was 11, 18 when I came home, and I wasn't boss, but, you know, my wife and I shared it, but we said, when we go home, remember, if you got a wife and your kids are still there, they're boss. Mom is boss. And that just proved it. But we talked about jobs, sex, kids, families, catching up, all that Rip Van Winkle stuff that we missed out on. And when we came home, we were so much better adjusted than had we come home right after 3 years, right out of torture and solitary. Then we would have been goofy, like our families were told that, you know, they won't be able to make a simple decision even. Well, we got home, we said, come on, let's go, we got to catch up. But that was because we had those years to, I don't know if it was decompressed, but we weren't professional counselors, but we did. We counseled each other, we talked these things through, and it was so helpful, so to speak. Well, it was helpful, very helpful.
And of course, during those years when you were captive, the government kept the Medal of Honor secret so that the North Vietnamese wouldn't be able to target you.
Along with Billy Sparks, who did a lot of research, there was another guy who did some of that research in the squadron where I was. And the neat thing about being a Medal of Honor recipient, not a winner, but a recipient, is that your peers recommend it. It doesn't come from above. It's your guy in your left and right wing. But anyway, this other guy was shot down about 6 months after was doing some research. So with the TAP code, a couple of years after I was there, it came through the TAP code, Leo, did you know you've been nominated for the Medal of Honor? So that's how I found out about that I'd been nominated.
And during those years, did you heard a great deal about the peace movements and what was going on in America?
Yes, because it was a lot of it was exaggerated greatly, but we had what they called the camp radios. Old days, you turn on a radio and go click, and they had little speakers like that, one speaker wired in every cell, a little cell or a big cell, and you'd hear the click turn on, they'd say, you know, here are the news, or here is a new. But they exaggerated. Remember, I was from South Dakota, where my wife was. In Rapid City, South Dakota, that killed 2,000. Well, it turned out to be about 200, but they exaggerated everything by at least 10. But the point was, we did get, you could read something into going on. So that was helpful, and it was disappointing about all the people going to Canada and so on, but we were getting some news, albeit exaggerated.
Did you hear about Jane Fonda while you were in?
Of course we did. I was fortunate. Anytime a delegation came to Hanoi, they would just about randomly pick out a POW or two or three and go to work on you, and they had a lot of time. And when they took you to a delegation, they could only see your face, your hands, and your feet. They couldn't see your body. And it was very bad to be selected to see a delegation because they wanted you to recognize, or not to memorize some answers to the questions that they would be asked. And I didn't go see Jane Fonda. I did another delegation. It was severe. She was just the name that was well known. There were a few others, but we have the right, and I'll fight for it so that we can speak our mind and do what we want to and demonstrate in our country. But when you go into the enemy's land, then that's you're a traitor, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that one of the things that comes out of the work that I'm doing is that people will wake up to both the problems that have happened over the years of so many of the veterans in general, and particularly all of the veterans from Vietnam who have faced all of these problems with the VA hospitals. I still don't know why they can't not get their act together and take care of you guys and you know, really clear this up. With the number of veterans that we have coming now and who are in the system, I still get emails and calls from veterans.
Yes.
who are having problems. You know,
Absolutely. It's
crazy. You guys are really our heroes. You fought and dedicated yourselves to protecting us. And so I'm hopeful that, you know, people will just wake up and say, we've had enough. The veterans' hospitals have to be cleaned up. And just recently, a few weeks ago, there was a story about literally cleaned up, not just the problems, but that there should be hospitals that are found dirty and filthy. It just has to end.
Some of the VAs used to be bad, now are good. Some of them used to be good and aren't real good now. But I don't know, maybe Pat, it's such a massively big bureaucracy. We've had good VA directors that come in, they're successful generals or whatever, and yet the bureaucracy just is so big, and I'm not making excuses for them, but the other thing is there's no accountability. If somebody makes a mistake, it's hard to fire them, just like the IRS or any other government agency. That's not an excuse, but it happens.
Well,
it's so frustrating.
There's some of them, I wish they were in the military, we could court-martial them, and
exactly.
Then they'd get their act together, I think, if we could.
I think you're right.
Yeah, that might work. You know, maybe that's an idea.
Well, yeah, put them all back in the military. Everybody works at the VA, and then we can fire them.
Exactly.
You work on that, will you?
I think I will. You know, that's a good idea. I just realized that if we threw a few of them in Leavenworth, I bet they'd get organized real fast.
I think so.
That would work, huh? Well, you know, I just want to thank you so much for joining me today. And I one of the things I told one of my guests a few weeks ago, she wrote a book called Fairy Tales Can Come True, Ricky Kleeman. And she, you know, really believes that. And she is always telling women, you know, follow your dreams. And if you do, they will come true. And so in my case, talking to you, and of course, yesterday I got to talk to your beautiful wife. How many years have you been married now?
61, and it's going to work.
See, yeah, I think she's turned out okay.
Well, yeah, she's
She's a keeper, huh?
She's better than okay. She's a keeper. By the way, can I make one other quick comment?
Absolutely.
It doesn't help the guys coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, or maybe, but when we came back from Hanoi, as you know, Vietnam veterans were being spit on, and they were treated so badly, and people took it out on the war. On the warrior when they didn't like the war. At least we learned that lesson. People still respect our veterans. But when we came home, the POWs, this handful of us, we were treated better than we deserved. That's true. And versus really treating the other ones badly. And so when I would go somewhere and they say, well, Leo Tharsis is here and he's a POW and a Medal of Honor guy, would you please stand, please? And when I stood, I'd say yes. And would all other Vietnam veterans please stand? Because I've always said, it does not take a lot of skill to become a POW, not to survive, but it was, you know, and I found out later that the only thing that America had to be happy about after Vietnam was, you can argue we won, we lost, we came in between, but the one thing we could be happy about, America was, is they were happy about when the POWs came home. So we replaced a victory, so to speak, and we get treated really better than deserved, especially when you compare us to the hundreds of thousands that came home. You know, there's just a handful. So I still have a little guilt feeling that we were treated so well, and typical veteran really get dumped on.
Exactly. That's why I've included the ground crews in my whole project. And I want to thank you so much for being on today. And I'm going to play the Thud song for you. because I play it every day.
Yes. Wonderful.
that's how I get myself motivated to keep working on this project, because it's so important. And right. Just thank you so much, Colonel Thorsness. It's been an honor to talk to you.
You're doing good work. Keep it up. And as I hang up, I'm looking at the website for Forgotten 105 Warriors.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, best of y'all. Thanks, ladies.
It was nice meeting you.
Thud pilot, I love my plane. It is my body, I am its brain. My Thunder Chief loves me, and I love her too. But I get the creeps with only one seat and one engine too. Faster than lightning, it says on her dials. To get a Thud airborne takes only 2 miles. She's packed with transistors, black boxes, diodes. But stay alert, 'cause you might get hurt when she explodes. She totes more bombs.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with Tina Basil, the wife of Gene Basil, who wrote Pack 6, and their daughter, Tracy Stanich.
Hi.
Hi, it's so nice to have you here with me today so that we you could join in to listen to Colonel Thorsness.
Oh, it was
Isn't
wonderful.
He fantastic? No. He's just my hero. Let's talk a little bit about Pack Six, which is a great book that I really enjoyed writing the script for. And Gene also wrote another book called The River Rats, which follows adventures after he came back from Vietnam. Tell me a little bit about Tina. When were you and Gene married?
We were married in 62.
And you, of course, come from where did he pick you up? Huh? Where did he pick you up, Tina?
I come from Aviano, Italy, where they have the base that they've had there since the late 1800s. And he was doing his NATO rotation.
Uh-huh. And he saw this beautiful, cute little Italian girl.
Right after the Berlin crisis.
Uh-huh.
That's why, you know, and that's when I met him.
And he saw this cute little Italian girl and said,
I don't know about that.
I think so. and so then you were married in Italy.
We were married in Aviano, uh-huh. Yes. And then
and then you followed him from base to base.
Well, we went to Myrtle Beach. That's uh-huh. where we went to begin with. And then we lived in, we went to Japan, Misawa, which was his second tour.
And Tracy?
Tracy was born in Omaha, Nebraska.
Yes.
He had gone back to, he was finishing up some kind of, he was at the university there for 6 months.
Well, you know, it's I really am so thankful for you to come in today. Both of Gene's books are available on Amazon, Pack Six and The River Rat. And, of course, Colonel Thorsness's book is also available on Amazon and is called Surviving Hell. And, you know, it is so wonderful to read these books. It really takes you back to that period and opens your eyes. And they're both have written very compelling books, inspirational books, and books about real American heroes. And as Gene Basil always said, real American heroes are just ordinary people who are willing to take a chance and willing to risk their lives for others. And Gene was one of those, and luckily he was rescued. And so it was an honor to have you both here today.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
And so remember, this is Patsy with a Z, and I'm wishing everyone a great week. One of the joys of life is to read and to write. So join me next Tuesday at 11 a.m. for Joy on Paper. Meanwhile, remember, don't let anyone steal your joy. Treasure it and share it. And be grateful. And God bless America. And God bless Colonel Thorsness.